From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. On the panel this week, Philippe Gelly, U.S. Chief Correspondent for Le Figaro, and Dan Raviv, National Correspondent for Israeli-based I-24 News. Our moderator is CBS Radio contributor Michael Williams.
Welcome, everyone. Here are the issues. At the recent G20 summit in Argentina, the United States and China agreed to a temporary truce in their ongoing trade war. But the arrest of a key Chinese business executive is jeopardizing the planned negotiations even before they begin. The government of French President Emmanuel Macron withdrew its planned tax increases, this in the face of weeks of national protests, some of which turned violent in the capital of Paris. We examine the causes and the costs. A number of developments involving defendants close to the Trump campaign signaled a new sense of urgency in the investigation into Russian election meddling. And we examine the life and legacy of George H.W. Bush, the 41st president of the United States, who died last week at the age of 94. So, gentlemen, let's start off with the China-U.S. tariff talks, or we'll see if there are talks or how the talks are actually going. The agreement that was reached was sort of a political agreement to give each side more political time to avoid a trade war. But this arrest of the Chinese executive seemed to lob kind of a bomb into that whole situation. Dan, do you want to characterize what's happened here so far in terms of the talks and who that Chinese official was who was arrested?
Well, it may surprise you that I actually don't think the arrest of the chief financial officer of Huawei, Chinese company that makes cell phones and makes a lot of mobile phones. It's the second biggest manufacturer in the world.
Even bigger than Apple.
Yes, it's second only to Samsung. And a lot of Americans don't know Huawei, but around the world, it is a known brand and it's very affordable. Well, anyway, the arrest of the chief financial officer, I don't think is going to ruin the talks. The talks are bigger. And let's just go back more than a week ago when in Buenos Aires, Argentina, the leaders of the world's biggest economies were gathering for the Group of 20 summit. And the summit itself, you know, as usual, was filled with complicated issues where officials of more than 20 governments were looking at trade and economy. But everybody was just talking about the United States and China, because when Group of 20 ended, that's when President Trump and Xi Jinping, the president of China, had their working dinner.
And to be clear, we're talking about the two largest economies in the world.
Well, it's incredible. And they're meeting in Buenos Aires, Argentina, far from the capital cities of both countries. But still, they brought their main teams on the economy and trade. And as soon as it ended, the American side said this went great. President Trump claimed wonderful successes, that China had agreed to buy a lot more products that are made in America. Therefore, it looked like we have a chance of a trade deal. So President Trump said he would hold off on his threat to increase from 10% to 25% the tariff, which is really a tax on many Chinese goods coming into America. He would hold off to allow for 90 days of negotiating. So we were very optimistic, but when Monday rolled around, we weren't hearing much from China. The stories eventually didn't really seem to match. And in America, on Tuesday, the stock market went way down. And it was a rocky week in general for investors, as there just wasn't much faith in President Trump saying that things were going well.
And Philippe, the Chinese executive, though, did in fact get arrested, a very high official. And Huawei, let's be clear, there is a feeling that Huawei is sort of an extension of the Chinese government and Chinese military, and they are out to corner the key technologies that are going to lead advances into the future for the next 5, 10, maybe 20 years.
The Chinese government is very protective of Huawei. The American government is very suspicious of this company,
exactly,
for the same reasons. And there is the implicit accusation of espionage.
And isn't it tantamount to arresting a government official when you arrest an official of Huawei?
I'm not sure you can say that. The thing is, at this point, we still don't know exactly what is the accusation in detail. There is the rumor of some violation of the U.S. embargo toward Iran. It's not yet detailed in legal papers. This lady is still in Canada.
Right, being detained by Canadian
authorities. Exactly, and there is an extradition request.
So it doesn't strike me as the same as arresting a Chinese government official. It doesn't strike me that way. Her name is Meng Wanzhou, by the way. I don't think this is a crisis, her arrest.
It was important enough for Department of Justice to inform the National Security Advisor, who just admitted that he knew in advance at the time when the two presidents had this dinner in Buenos Aires. They knew, his advisors, at least his national security
advisors. At least the American side knew.
Yeah, that the arrest was about to happen. And they wouldn't inform him for any, you know, small fish that just happened to be caught in this big net. So it's very political. There is a diplomatic dimension to this crisis. It doesn't mean that it will compromise the dialogue between the two countries to the point that, you know, we would be heading toward a trade war without escape.
Dan, the battle seems to be in the Trump administration, the battle between the globalists and the hardliners, as it has been from the beginning. And to this point, it seems like the hardliners kind of have the upper hand. As you see this going forward, in these 90 days of negotiations, we'll get there. Who really does, in your opinion, have the upper hand? Who's running this thing? And how is this likely to pan out between the two factions within the White House, if you will?
Well, I'd say that Donald Trump is happy to give the impression that he is not a globalist, as he has said he's a nationalist. He only cares about America doing well. And so in particular, in trade talks, if he's just looking out for American interests, he tweeted the other day, "I am Mr. Tariff." And so he's not just threatening to impose tariffs. He already has, even against our neighbors like Canada. And he believes in it as an instrument, he says, that not only puts pressure on the other side, but makes us money. President Trump thinks that many people around the world have forgotten that when you impose a tariff, you collect money. And he says America's collecting billions of dollars by imposing this tariff or tax on Chinese products. He said if the talks don't work out, that's fine. We're making money. I think he's therefore not talking about the fact that American consumers would suffer because we Americans like to get cheap goods from overseas.
But doesn't the president have a point as far as American companies are being forced and coerced into giving up technology in order to even partner with companies in the Chinese mainland? And there is an issue. There's an ongoing issue with intellectual property theft. There is a point. Yeah. But is the question really, is tariffs the right way to handle
And Philippe, by the way, do you think they have a point when, say, John Bolton, whom you mentioned, right, who works for the White House, he said on Friday that Americans should think about how China does trade and business, and whether we want to be trading with them.
It's a fact that if you want to do business in China, very often you are coerced to share your knowledge, your
technology to be handed over,
and this is the heart of the dispute between broadly the West and China.
Correct.
And the proper way, I mean, the argument, at least in Europe, was that you don't start another trade war with Europe. You join with Europe to try to correct this problem in behavior on the part of China, because the Europeans are facing the exact same issue.
Well, we've seen so far from the Trump administration that he does like a good fight, but is not necessarily the best at building coalitions. So we'll see how he does in the one-on-one trade talks that are coming over the next 90 days. Let's move on to the French protests. I have numbers of, and you may have updated numbers, Philippe, 4 killed, hundreds injured in protests that engulfed France and turned very violent in Paris. Just give us the basics of what the protests were about at the beginning and where the issue spread to, because it seems it sort of metastasized.
Absolutely.
over a very short
period of
time.
The spark was another tax on gasoline. By the way, it was decided by François Hollande, the previous president, not by this one, Emmanuel Macron, but it was supposed to be applied starting in January. So the first demonstration were supposedly about this. Very, very quickly, it spilled over to become a protest against overtaxation and the way the state is badly managed. And although there is a very large safety net in France, people have the feeling that they are overtaxed and that the state doesn't use their money as it should, because the deficit is very high, unemployment is very high, the debt is very high, and reforms are very hard to make. Now, after the fourth act this weekend, it's a much bigger issue. I mean,
it's become a referendum on the governing style of Emmanuel Macron.
Not only him. Yes, it's very much centered on this president, his style of governing,
his philosophy of governing, let's say.
What happened is that some perceived his election as being a levy against populism. You can argue the opposite. He was kind of an immediate step in this populism tide, in the sense that he campaigned as the anti-party guy, the outsider. His party didn't exist 2 years ago. And, you know, very quickly it has morphed into the new establishment.
That was very quick indeed, because it was only in the middle of last year that he was elected. Right. Macron was not a man of either of the main two parties. So in the runoff, it was just Macron against Marine Le Pen, thought of as a populist nationalist, then called the National Front. Didn't he get 70% of the votes? That's about right. It was in the runoff.
Yeah, over 65.
So it gave the world the impression that he's also really popular with his En Marche, On the March party. That was the impression. And so, you know, even President Trump thought the guy is really cool. He's the youngest president of the French Republic ever. Mm-hmm. Some Americans thought it was even cool that he had married his teacher, 25 years older. There were just so many things about him that Americans thought were cool. And then that visit to the White House, the long, long handshakes with President Trump. What an interesting person. And now it's filtering into America that, well, let me put it this way. He's a loser. And the Trump tweets about Emmanuel Macron point out the very low popularity rating. Right. You know, it says Macron...
23% at this time.
Macron is trying to distract people from the real subject because his popularity rating is really well down. So Trump seems to have decided that he's a loser. So from an American point of view, there's really no big desire to make him the center of America's relationship with Europe. And I thought about a year ago, Trump thought maybe Macron's the guy.
Well, that was over already when after the Macron's visit to Washington back in the spring, because Emmanuel Macron tried to be the guy who could talk to Donald Trump on any occasion on behalf of the Europeans.
And wasn't he even trying to draw Trump back, if he could, to the Paris Climate Change Accord?
Yeah, and the second challenge was to have him not destroy the Iranian nuclear deal with Iran. And he failed on those two, and since then it's over. But to go back to what's going on in France, I think it's a crisis of regime, almost.
Well, let me give you a question as we close out this topic. The government has reversed the proposal for right now, and it said it's going to delay imposing these taxes that sparked the whole thing in the first place. It can reverse this proposal. Can it reverse the political damage?
No, and it hasn't had any impact. They have backtracked on this tax. It doesn't change a thing, because now it's much more about how you govern, how people feel they are not well represented by the elected class, if you want. And the demands of the protesters, we should say that there is no leaders among these yellow vests. There are 13 groups on Facebook speaking on their behalf. They don't even want themselves to have any spokesperson. And so it's very, very difficult to sit down with someone and try to find a solution to this very deep crisis.
We're going to have to put a pin in that for right now. We'll take a break and come back with more Issues in the News.
Issues in the News is coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, go ahead and check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also, visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel. Philippe Jelly, U.S. Chief Correspondent for Le Figaro. And Dan Raviv, National Correspondent for Israeli-based I-24 News. Our moderator is CBS Radio contributor Michael Williams.
Welcome back. Let's go on to the Russia probe. Probe took on a sense of real urgency, I believe, this week as several sort of momentous things, many, many earth shocks, earthquakes happened as Special Prosecutor Robert Mueller filed documents that recommended that convicted Trump administration official Michael Flynn receive no prison time. We have longtime Trump aide and confidant Roger Stone saying that he will take the fifth if he's indicted and he fully expects to be indicted. You have Paul Manafort expecting to receive sentencing recommendations now that his plea agreement blew up. There is so much going on with this group of people who are key to this. Let's start with the Michael Flynn, if you will, Dan. Is that okay?
He was the national security advisor at the beginning of the Trump administration.
And a decorated war general, generally considered to be one of the best tacticians in modern American history.
Intelligence, by the way, not shooting a gun. And so he was head, in fact, of the Defense Intelligence Agency under President Obama. But Obama decided he doesn't trust him, that the guy has some strange ideas, and Obama fired him. That made Flynn very political, if I can take it back to 2015 and 2016.
I think it's wise to, so we get an understanding of who this man actually is.
So Flynn, during the 2016 campaign, delighted going coast to coast, usually with Donald Trump, the candidate, in saying that Obama is terrible and we need new leadership. And he even led chants at the big Republican convention of the crowd chanting, "Lock her up," about Hillary Clinton. We didn't expect this from a former military man who'd been head of an intelligence agency. So he became very partisan, very, very pro-Trump, etc. But he only lasted 3 weeks in the White House because evidence was given to President Trump that Michael Flynn had had meetings and contacts with the Russian embassy here in Washington that Flynn had not reported. Later, we also learned that he was doing business with Turkey. And it's alleged that Flynn did not register his work as, it's often called, an agent of a foreign government. And so he didn't do things right, is what's alleged. So he was fired, and then he pleaded guilty to one count of lying to the FBI as it investigated what he had done with his contacts with Russia. Friends of Flynn say all of that is unfair. He's still a war hero. He was being unfairly pursued by prosecutors like the special prosecutor, Robert Mueller, who hate Trump and want to get rid of Trump. That's the right-wing or conservative story. But then this past week, we learned that Flynn has been helping the prosecutor, apparently with enthusiasm, with nearly 24 long meetings, lots of information. And the court filing was redacted, meaning there were whole paragraphs that looked just like black lines. We in the public couldn't see it. The judge could see it as he considers the sentencing. And it said, we recommend that Flynn not get any prison time. He's been so cooperative in
blank.
Secret, it, secret, secret.
And this is the story. We have so many fill in the blanks here. And now we actually have a document that has blanks that need to be filled in. When you look at that sentencing document, you look at Michael Cohen pleading guilty to lying to Congress. And clearly the members of Congress have said that there are others who they want to call back because they feel that they have definitely lied to Congress.
And look at Cohen, all these by the way, let's remember, was Donald Trump's lawyer for many, many
lawyer,
years.
Confidant, business partner. He knows where the bodies are buried, as the phrase goes.
So he's been helping too.
Philippe, where do you think this is going? Do we think that we're getting closer, the signals just being closer, to a final report by Robert Mueller?
Well, it's getting closer to the president and his inner circle, definitely. And you can sense it. I mean, how nervous he is. You can see it in the tweets and so on and so forth. As you mentioned, Flynn spent 19 hours with the investigators, and he cooperated to 3 investigations, 1 being the Russian investigation, 2 being secret investigations. We don't know anything about those. What we know is that on the 2 main issues concerning Donald Trump, one is collusion with Kremlin or Russian government. You can bet at this point that Robert Mueller, the special prosecutor, knows everything there is to know.
He's got it, doesn't he?
Yeah.
He's got it.
Definitely. With so many witnesses he has flipped and cooperating with him, I think he's filled the blanks. Maybe not us yet because of all these redacted documents. On the second question, that is obstruction of justice, there it's a legal debate in large part. When you look at how you qualify for such behavior, I mean, tampering witnesses, what is the president doing right now? He is granting
like
a pardon to those who don't cooperate with the investigator. Is that tampering witnesses? There is a lot of things that have to be decided in a legal framework, in a court of justice. And on this side as well, I think the special prosecutor knows more than he needs.
Dan?
Well, that doesn't mean necessarily that Donald Trump as the candidate was involved in some illegal contacts with Russians or with hackers or with WikiLeaks, etc. Of course, Donald Trump might have kept himself at a great distance from it. So it's speculated that the suspects could include his son, who was involved in the campaign, Donald Trump Jr., his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, who is now on the White House staff as an advisor, and of course others, and maybe Paul Manafort, who was campaign chairman. I mean, it might stop there. Everyone talks about it's getting really close to Trump.
We already know that the testimony of Michael Cohen contradicts that of Don Jr. to the Congress last year. We already know that because Don Jr. said that there was no dealing with Russia whatsoever, that he was not aware of any plan or project to build a Trump Tower in Moscow, which is contradicted by Michael Cohen.
One of the revelations that the Trump Organization did want to make money in Russia. So you come up with possible motives that candidate Donald Trump was so concerned about making money, and he has publicly said recently, so I was a candidate. It was possible I was going to lose the election. What do you want me to do, give up my business? And so his argument would be to the public, the president of the United States would say, I'm not affected by that. Sure, I have a hotel in Washington, D.C., used by foreign governments, but it doesn't affect my decisions. That's what he would say. Again, who's going to believe him?
But will he
be impeached or removed from office over this? Probably not.
He's also saying right now he's undermining the very institutions that are investigating that could exonerate him.
I don't think undermining is a fair word.
I think it's a very fair word.
Oh, really? I think he's criticizing it. He's trying to get his base of voters to think that the main prosecutor-investigator Robert Mueller is dishonest. Mueller and his gang of 17 angry Democrats. Trump repeatedly writes that as though he's being mistreated.
That's exactly what the grand jury will have to decide.
Yeah.
They will have to decide.
Undermining or just fair game to criticize.
Well, when you call the prosecutor crooked, when you say that you have 10 angry Democrats, when you've fired one person who was leading the investigation, I think that it seems as though he's not only undermining this particular investigator, but the very institutions that would investigate him or anyone else.
And one thing to look out for is the president soon will nominate another attorney general. The Senate would have hearings and decide whether to confirm that person. And that will be a test, whether Trump goes for an inner Trump loyalist or someone perhaps who's more respected around the country.
We'll close on this one, and I'll throw it out to the two of you. Will we get a final report before the end of the year? And if so, what will be the Trump response?
Political. Won't be legal. He will be, he will address his base. Yeah. He will defend himself to the last last inch.
Now, we don't know whether the report from Prosecutor Robert Mueller comes out this month before the end of the year. We don't know.
No, we don't know.
No, I speculate. There were some
I would say it's Republicans with wishful thinking who say that Mueller's near the end of his job. Considering that those papers were redacted with the black paragraphs that you couldn't read, that means that Mueller is still protecting his ongoing investigation.
Absolutely. Multiple investigations. And we don't know at this point now if it's an investigation into only the meddling by the Russians in the Trump campaign, but has it spread into the Trump organization? And to me, it seems like we've spread into the Trump organization.
There are signs of that.
Which is a whole nother thing. Let's move on to George Herbert Walker Bush, 41st president of the United States, who passed away recently at the age of 94. We all grew up following, and it was my president, and you watched him from afar. I just wanted to touch on his accomplishments and his failures and his legacies. I'm going to start with you. We just have a couple of minutes. And your impressions of George H.W. Bush as a president and as a man, Philly.
Well, we've heard so many good things about him in the last few days, and it's only normal, I would say. He lived a full life. Very few people digged into his failures, his shortcomings as a president. You know, the family had decided that this funeral wouldn't be about Donald Trump, like Senator McCain's funeral earlier this year. They have tried hard. Whatever you try, you seem to fail, because when you hear the eulogy of such a man, people saying he loved the truth, he would share the credit and shoulder the blame. Well, you can't help drawing some comparison with the current president. So, and I think any president in the eyes of the mainstream media, as Donald Trump would say here,
any president would look ascendant compared to the Trump administration. Dan, your thoughts?
We have to note that President Trump was in the front row listening to all of that. The funeral in the National Cathedral here in Washington lasted for 2 hours, and Trump sat there silently with his wife, Melania, and all the other living presidents were there, by the way, just down that front row, Obama and his wife, Clinton, and his wife, Hillary. Jimmy Carter at age 94 and his wife, and they were all listening, and they weren't conversing. It was an uncomfortable situation. Trump especially is so different that the other presidents don't even chat with him, but Trump was listening, and he had to have heard how George H.W. Bush was praised as a great man for being humble.
As a great man for being a good man, wouldn't you say?
But Donald Trump thinks he's a good person, too, by making America great. What he was hearing was that there's this amazing national funeral broadcast all around the world, and the attributes of George H.W. Bush, and I can only imagine that Trump was thinking to himself, is that what I want to be? Or it would be more like Trump to think, I can be great and have a great funeral one day with other things. He built up the economy. He changed the trade picture. Those are the things that interest Trump. He's not interested in the same things as George H.W. Bush.
Well, I just want to close by saying that George H.W. Bush was not a perfect man. He did not vote for civil rights legislation when he was in the Congress. He was not a perfect politician. He was a one-term president, but he did lead effectively one of the greatest military coalitions and effective that we've seen. He was, by all accounts, a very good man, and I think that his legacy will be that. And with his funeral, I think we're eulogizing as much an era as we were a man. There's a quote by a writer, Horton Foote, that says, little by little, the look of the land changes based on the men we choose to admire. And I think that we all do well to admire a man like George H.W. Bush. That's all the time we have. Thanks to Philip Gilly, U.S. Chief Correspondent for Le Figaro, and Dan Raviv, National Correspondent for Israeli-based I-24 News. This program is produced by VOA Current Affairs. Our engineer is Justin Thwaite. And I'm Michael Williams, CBS Radio contributor. Thanks for listening.